It is time to welcome Artistic Director of the Sitka Summer Music Festival, Zuhal Bailey, to the program. Welcome, Zuhal.
Good evening.
So we are we're fortunate to have you in this week because you've been a very, very busy person. How'd the festival go this year?
I couldn't have asked for a better festival. It was a very much controlled chaos in that we did everything we'd hoped to do and more. The musicians were as active as they've ever been. Along with presenting music all over the city, the island, touring to Homer and Anchorage, as well as being affiliated with the fine arts camp and the educational things. There was definitely something for everyone. And it's a little bit longer than it usually was in the past. So, you know, the musicians came in revved each chapter. There were three different chapters of musicians. But the administration, the supporters, the board, everyone kept up the same energy level as the musicians did coming in, and now we're just kind of sitting back, cleaning up, and kind of reveling in what we've done and the reverberations that that they're going to create throughout the rest of the season.
You tried a few new things this year, and some of your first impressions, it seemed like there was some kind of interactive stuff, and the learning how a piece is written or practiced or perfected. Tell me a little bit about some of the stuff you tried.
Well, this could also parlay into kind of why we're here tonight, that music is what happens and why music is created. And the behind the scenes is what activates in many ways how we react to it. And so we had open rehearsals. We had works in progress. We discovered the composer's intentions behind it, discussions with the artists. The audiences here are there's no door to separate the artists and the audience. And so with now the acquisition of Stevenson Hall on Sheldon Jackson's campus, having our headquarters here, there is no line anymore. So everyone feels like they're part of the process.
Great. Well, we do have a lot of music to celebrate tonight, and so we're going to get to that real soon, but I do have to address a rumor that I heard, and so I think it's time that we either confirm it or just get rid of it. But I heard that maybe that hike up to the top of Mount Edgecombe would feature you taking your cello to the top.
You know, I have heard rumors that I've given the impression over my 41 years on this earth that I'm a daredevil and that I always kind of shock people with my ability and to jump into the deep end of whatever I'm doing. I come up with these things because I have no regrets in my life. I don't ever want to look back and think, oh, I should have, because I've never lived my life that way. Last summer, I climbed Mount Edgecombe for the first time, which is the volcano, of course, and had such a glorious time doing it, spiritual in many ways. And I got to the top, walked around the entire rim, slept up there for about an hour and a half to rest my body. And the whole time I was walking up there, I kept whistling and humming music from my life. As I got more and more fatigued, it brought different kinds of music to me. And I don't know what that meant, but I started understanding even more so the importance of music in my life and where I came from. And when I was approached again about going up there, I thought, now, huh, I know physically I can do it, but can I carry a cello the 18-hour round-trip walk to the top of this volcano? And then once up there, when I've got the spiritual kind of accessibility to the heavens, can I produce the music that's in my head on my cello? And so I am taking my carbon fiber cello on my back on this trek. I believe it's 9 miles to the top. And carry a chair and carry a change of clothing and food and everything else and then play for everyone at the top of the volcano. And you know what? I'm going to do it. So at 6:30 in the morning, I start my trek up and I'm going to document it and try to play my most favorite music when I'm up there depending upon how I feel.
That should be spectacular.
I hope so.
But before you reach the pinnacle, we're going to have to cast you away and send you to a deserted island. And so, Zuhal, hang on. Well, Zool, you wake up and you're on the sand. And you've got 10 songs to last you until you're rescued, which might take forever. So we asked you to come up with these 10 songs and bring them, and we're going to listen to them here tonight. Before we play song one and dive into the list, when you agreed to do this, did you like have maybe most of that list already in your head, or was this an exercise where you really had to start from scratch?
I have days of music in my head all the time. I have a very good memory to not only perform, but to remember pieces, and they activate different thoughts and feelings. And it was difficult for me because I had to decide what, being on this island, what would bring me the greatest pleasure for different reasons. And so once I kind of sat there in this theoretical island, symbolic island, I realized very clearly what was most important to me. And this is why I chose the 10. They represent very different things and for very different reasons.
Was the exercise enjoyable or difficult, or what kind of mix of emotion did you bring?
I don't really go based. I'm a big thinker, but I don't. I base many of the things that I do on instinct, and I don't overthink things once the instinct comes into play. I go free flow into that, and because you can kind of talk yourself out of anything once you start analyzing to death. You know, this was very clear to me once it started flowing. And it kind of easy because, I'll explain it to you as we go along.
Okay. And I do have to ask you one more question. What kind of an island? You get to choose what kind of an island that you're on. And so please describe a little bit, tropical, more of the Alaskan sort.
Those who know me know that I'm not a beach sitter. I don't like to bake in the sun. I've got sort of dark skin as it is, and I prefer to use my mind and kind of brew about with what I see versus kind of sit there and feel my skin popping and burning. So it would definitely be the Sitka Beach here, where I'd walk and see life and different kinds of adventurous things going on versus just a basic sandy beach.
All right. Let's get into your music list. Okay. We've got 10 songs, and we'll talk a little bit about this first song, and then we'll play it, and then we'll play the second one, and after the second one, we'll come back and talk about the second song and kind of hop that way throughout the show. So the first tune, before we say what it is.
We're not going to say what it is.
We're not going to say
what it is.
Let's
say what it is after the fact.
Do you want to talk a little bit at all about why you chose it, or you want to talk about that after the fact? We can do it whichever way you like.
Let's start very peacefully. Let's start with just a place where you kind of just take a deep breath. And you're sitting there on the beach, and you kind of you need to kind of delve into where it all began.
Die!
Kiss, Detroit Rock City. Really?
Only my closest friends know of that I was a member of the Kiss Army, and they know that I collected the Kiss dolls. I had the Kiss color forms. I had the Kiss trash can, the Kiss cards. I was the biggest fan of Gene Simmons. I mean, I was crazy about this. And, you know, it was the first recording, the first LP that I ever bought. I saved up every penny I could as a child. And it was really what made music rock me. And it's funny how this has come back through different times in my life. And I chose that because it is truly where it all began. It's how music moves you based on where you are and what it means. And music also activates a time in your life that it represents. And so that represents probably 4 years old, 5 years old. And I'll never forget it. And every time I see anything with Kiss, still to this day, and I heard them play for the first time in concert in Albuquerque about 10 years ago, and it blew my mind. I'd never been to a rock concert still to that day, from 4 years old to, I don't know, 37 years old, 35 years old. And so it was the power of music. Could have been the Kabuki makeup. It could have been, you know, the big show, the fireworks, all the things that they put into just more than just the crazy music itself. But I was a rambunctious child, and it gave me something to jump around on and throw myself around with.
What did your parents think of your love of Kiss?
I loved Monsters. I loved energy, like just bottled up energy. So they thought it made sense. The LP that they were most offended by was Hotter Than Hell, there, because they would say, "Oh, you can't have that Hotter Than Bleep record." and I collected them all, and I went full into the 80s with following that band until they actually took their makeup off, and but it opened the door again to listening to music and sitting down and just taking my time to read the LP covers and to study them. I actually, it began also my art obsession with drawing. Everything about it started with that, and also my collector mentality. I mean, there's many things of my personality that, and so if I were on a desert island, a deserted island, this is not just the music. It's all of those memories. It's like a family album mm-hmm. of my household growing up, sitting in my room, locking my door, and being surrounded by this circus of color and imagination.
Zuul, you and I share that.
I can tell
that,
this, by the way.
That moment of my first musical passion, all-consuming love of music was Kiss. And I had posters and a whole wall and all the albums. And so I don't even need to ask you to list the four musicians and their characters, but for the sake of those that don't know, could you run through them?
Well, Paul Stanley, Peter, Chris, Ace Frehley, and Gene Simmons. Those are the ones that always started with me.
And their makeup?
Well, of course, Paul Stanley's the star child. Ace Frehley's let's go back. Then Peter, Chris is the cat. Mm-hmm. Gene Simmons was the demon.
Mm-hmm. Ace Frehley was Spaceman.
Spaceman, yeah. Yeah, and that changed also during the whole disco thing that happened later on when the boots got higher, the platform boots. And but then when they started changing to Eric Carr and all these other guys, that was also when I started growing out of that. But gosh, I can't believe I haven't had a discussion about Kiss in 1981. And then my obsession with Raiders of the Lost Ark started. So that's where it kind of shifted.
Well, life has stages. So it might be time for the next stage
okay.
of your life.
Well, my sister is 3 years older. We did not really hang out, get along very much as children. But there's one distinctive memory I have that represents her from a lot of my childhood. And I love my sister, and she and I are very, very close now. And this next selection represents a very, very funny, funny part of my past that involves her.
Around.
Song called Stayin' Alive from the Bee Gees, and time is 8:38, and there are quite a few folks that are looking at the radios thinking, I thought I tuned in for the Deserted Island with Zool Bailey, artistic director of the Sitka Summer Music Festival, and the 10 songs that he would choose to have with him if stranded on a deserted island perhaps forever. What are you saying to them, Zool?
Put your seatbelt on. No, we're now kind of in the late 70s, early 80s time period of my life. And while I was behind my closed doors smashing Kiss and turning that stuff up, my sister was in the other room listening to Donna Summer and the Bee Gees and all this stuff, roller skating in the driveway and with her friend from next door. And, you know, I thought it was kind of cool, very different, but they just looked so happy. And it reminds me of just a happy childhood that I had of just long, long summer days. And
where'd you grow up?
In Woodbridge, Virginia.
What kind of a neighborhood?
Oh, very rural. Everybody had an acre or two of property, or there were horses around my house. We had a very, very long paved drive, kind of a colonial-style house with columns. And I was pretty much from 7 years old till I left for college, I lived in that house. And so all of my memories are there.
But, a big lawn to mow?
Yes, I did that too. Yes, yeah. I picked the weeds out from outside the windows and all this stuff on Saturday mornings as well. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the Bee Gees bring – I love the Bee Gees, and I guess I'm not alone in that. One time when I was in London about 7 years ago, I was at BBC Three, and I came walking in and to play on the radio live, and there was this huge commotion outside. And, of course, I assumed it wasn't for me. Being a cellist. And so I walked in and everyone was like, who's that, what's this, what's going on? Then a bunch of screaming happened. I looked back and it was Robin Gibb walking in. And I was like, oh my God, that is really cool. So it was, again, it just brought back this flood of memories that I didn't even know I really had. But the music really accesses those. And again, it comes back to family and where you grew up and all of those core values. And I have such a strong foundation in that regard of strength of family. And this music was kind of the soundtrack to that time. So, neat.
So, during that time, where are you in your own musical development? Were you, taking piano lessons since you were five? Or did you kind of come around to playing music a little later on? How does that fit?
I started, I was about 7-8 years into my musical study. I'd been playing piano and cello. My mom and my dad... My dad's a clarinetist and my mom's a pianist, and I grew up also under the piano.
Literally?
Yeah, because my in the bassinet, my mom would teach all day long, and so you put the bassinet, we didn't have babysitters, under the piano while she taught. And, you know, she was always there, and my dad was practicing clarinet all the time as well. But it was during this time, around right after the Bee Gees and Kiss, that I kind of started to realize that the cello was the thing that separated from everything else, including soccer, art, piano. I started kind of finding sort of my own identity, and I started to kind of pay attention to what my parents were doing and wondering about that kind of music. It seemed so sophisticated. And so subliminally, I started paying attention to what my mother was playing and my father was playing and why they liked it. And so this is why... This is the next selection that I chose that very much specifically represents something that I heard a lot because it was being worked on in the house, and it represents both my father and my mother, and also just kind of how music really plays a very important part in emotional growth in a child.
Thank you.
couple of different versions there. You want to explain a little bit about how Rhapsody in Blue happened in your life?
Well, it's interesting that it was chosen that way, because that's perfect in the scheme that, you know, I always heard my mother practicing it without the piano, without the orchestral part. And the version that you played first was Gershwin playing the piano edition. And then the second one, which was kind of the composite of representing symbolically my father opening the piece, which is, of course, that was the New York Philharmonic and Bernstein, mm-hmm. but and then the piano coming in later. But I sat under the piano. It feels like my entire childhood. My father was a conductor of bands in the 70s and early 80s, and my mother was asked to be the soloist of that ensemble several times. And I would assume that one of those times was the Gershwin Rhapsody in Blue. Mm. I've really never discussed it with them, but every time I hear it, I get this chill up my spine and a very strange warmth of security, representing both my father and my mother. So that was chosen. And of course, I repeat myself, but on a desert island, again, to remember one's parents in that regard and see them kind of doing the dance of a piece, mm-hmm. it's a magical moment.
When's the last time you've visited underneath a piano? Is it something that you've come back to and told stories and done on occasion, or is that just done?
To be honest, I've not heard the piece in its complete form since that time in my life, the Gershwin Rhapsody in Blue. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, when I play the cello, I find myself not sitting near that nook of the piano, because it brings back, it's a flood of too much. And so I separate myself and sit on the side where the pianist sits, so I can feel like I'm a partnership there versus that. Maybe that's a whole subliminal thing of staying away from that area just because it's the sacred area.
Right.
But yeah, that's quite an interesting thing to hear that piece. Thank you for playing it.
Well, you're very welcome. We have the next piece, the next part of your world of music as you're growing up. Tell us a little bit about it.
In the 1980s, the great cellist Mstislav Rostropovich was very prevalent in D.C. He was our local cellist and local conductor of the National Symphony Orchestra. that was also when I started to kind of bloom as a cellist. And I say bloom, I started working very hard. I started entering competitions. I started kind of finding myself focusing ridiculously hard on the cello and trying to establish myself as an entity, as an individual, confidence, trying to decide where I was going with my life. And
let's talk a little bit about that moment right there. When you say to immerse yourself, how many hours are we talking on a day-to-day basis?
Well, from 13 or 14 on, it was 5 or 6 hours a day, mm-hmm. nonstop practicing. It was every day. And it really kind of excluded a lot of friendships that I could have had. I stopped sports. I literally would wake up before school, practice an hour and a half, practice at lunch during school, and then after school come home and practice another 3 or 4 hours and finish at 5 o'clock, mm-hmm. broken. I mean, absolutely, my hands were red. And then I would do a little bit of homework. I was smart enough to get by my homework on minimal work, because I had nothing left in my brain. After the practicing, and then I would go into the bedroom, turn the radio on to WGMS, which is a radio station in D.C., and fall asleep listening to symphony music. So that's almost the entire 1980s. Other than movies, I almost exclusively listened to classical music. I don't know why. It wasn't a specific choice that I need to do this, but there was a switch that happened. So I actually missed a huge chunk of what rock and roll and other kinds of music were happening during that time. I remember when the movie Rattle and Hum came out in high school with U2, and I thought, who are these people? I didn't know anything. And why are you wearing these buttons that say Duran Duran? And everyone wore buttons on their denim jackets back then. I didn't know any of that stuff. I was thinking about Rostropovich and Itzhak Perlman and these great figures. Leonard Bernstein was alive during that time. I'd opened up a whole trove of information that I wanted to understand. And so I went knee deep into it headfirst into it. And the next selection, I don't know which recording you're going to choose for this.
This will be, we're going to play...
Don't tell me the piece, but is it, who's
not
playing
the piece.
It?
This is, I think this is you.
Oh, okay. Well, I grew up hearing Rostropovich play this, and this was the piece that made me want to play the cello and be that guy to practice all the time. This was the piece that I played in competitions. This is the piece that won me the competitions. This is the piece that gave me the confidence to feel like I could do this.
This is your mountaintop.
This was the top of Mount Edgecombe. This was sitting there looking around saying, maybe this could be my future. Thank you.
Thank you.
is 7 minutes after 9 o'clock. This is Raven Radio KCAW in Sitka. You're listening to Deserted Island with Zule Bailey, Artistic Director of the Sitka Summer Music Festival, as tonight's castaway. Zule, why the cello?
Oh, basically the feeling that it gives me when I play it. Basically, the fact that I feel like it's a voice. It's the instrument that is most like the human voice. Basically, I feel that there is no block between my expression and getting the music out of that instrument. I wrap my arms around it when I play it. I didn't connect to the piano because I didn't feel like I could get on and into the piano when I tried to play it. The draw of the bow is kind of like a paintbrush. The drag on the fingers of the left hand when I'm able to vibrate and bend pitches like the voice. And I believe that, you know, in hindsight, it's easy to say this, but many composers' greatest works are for cello. It's a very human existence to play the cello. It expresses it a human kind of way. In the middle of the cello, it's as if someone's speaking to you. You can go up and sing also like a violin up high, and you can also kind of whisper down low. So it really encompasses all of the feelings that I've always felt that I need to get out.
You said the cello was most like the human voice. Mm-hmm. Is there science behind that statement?
Like the human voice is it's the range.
The range. I was wondering if every musician will say that about their instrument.
In the register that we're speaking right now, that's the middle part of the cello. The violin's very high most of the time. The bass is very low. But the cello has the expanse of the fingerboard and the length of string that it can go just as high and as low. But in the middle comfortable range, it's literally almost spoken. And so, again, basically music to me is just a basic beauty. It makes your mind and body become free when you hear it, and when, especially, my gosh, if you're lucky enough to play.
Do you know the musician Slam Stewart?
I don't.
Stand-up bass player from the world of jazz. Mm-hmm. And I think in the 40s or the 50s, might be wrong about that. And he did a fair amount of vocalizing along with his bass in some of the upper registers, so that while he's plucking his stand-up bass, he's also vocalizing. Mm-hmm. Have you ever done anything like that in some of your wilder practice sessions?
No, I definitely breathe a lot when I play, because I try to make it the phrasing along with the most perfect instrument we have is the human voice. So as we phrase things, we have to take breaths, and then as we phrase things on an animate object like a cello, to make it natural, one breathes between phrases. But I don't do that on purpose to add to the music. I just try to make it as seamless as possible.
Tell me about the instrument that you're playing now.
The cello that you just heard is a cello made in 1693 in Venice, Italy, by a man named Matteo Gofriller. Very, very historic instrument. The bass register is extraordinary. Very large instrument. It has a rose carved underneath the fingerboard, which looks like a stained glass window. One of two on earth instruments like this that has that design. And I've had it for about 16 years now. It's an extraordinary instrument. The instrument to me is meant to inspire the performer. Some people in the audiences don't have the ear to be able to discern between the two, but they can certainly discern and detect if the instrumentalist is not free and able to express themselves freely. So that this instrument gives me everything and keeps inspiring me. It's the perfect relationship.
When did you first, when you did first meet this instrument? I imagine that you sat down and you played something for the very first time. Do you remember what you played at that moment?
I remember the first time I played this instrument, hearing the sound that was inside of my head, actually in real life. And it wasn't a pretty thing. it was the, you know, the sound of music to me doesn't have to be perfect. It has to be real. Life has to be real. We can project and we can try to make something that's not there, but that means we're not living what's actually there. And so when I draw the cello and I hear pops and grits and grinds and I see smoke coming off the fingerboard because of the rosin, I see perspiration and the strings torquing, that's like the flexibility of flesh, and that is the flexibility of existing. And when I saw this happen on this cello, which I'd never felt before, I knew that what I'd heard in my head was actually meant to be, and then it was try to find a way to play it forever, which so far I have.
Before that last piece, you had talked about practicing for 5 or 6 hours a day during high school, mm-hmm. and that your goal was to be able to perform a piece like that.
My goal in high school was to sharpen my tools, to be able to play anything on the cello, to then somehow be able to release myself to be an expressive musician. You can't be a musician if you don't have the tools. So my younger years, the 1980s, were spent just almost debilitatingly so, crafting the tools that I needed to simply feel free to then, which is the next step.
And you had then to move on and continue to learn and find instructors, I imagine, that you would want to learn from. And so tell me a little bit about how you went through that process. So you've been through high school, you've won some competitions. Mm-hmm. How do you evaluate where you go next? Did you have a lot of options to choose from, or was there a clear path?
Well, I played for Pinka Zukerman in high school, a very famous violinist and violist and conductor. And he, in this very public class when I was 17, right before college, said, congratulations, you can play the cello. And he didn't smile when he said that. He said, now it's time to get a life. And he said, that's the one thing you have lacking, is you need to now have a life to express through your ability to play the instrument. And he looked at my parents and said, if I can give you one bit of advice, let him now have a life. And then there was college.
Wicked Garden from Stone Temple Pilots. Zuul, why that tune?
Oh, I skipped a huge portion of my childhood from, 12 to 18. And it's very, in many weird ways, that kind of harks back to Kiss. It kind of comes back to I educated myself, and then I decided to let my hair down a little bit because I had been so, not uptight, but so concerned with manicuring and kind of making, during those very formative years.
Focused.
Absolutely. Very Olympic focused. Mm-hmm. And that's when I grew my hair out. And that's when I had very, very short hair my entire life. And I wore preppy things and this and that. And all of a sudden, one day, I walked into college and I realized that I was overprepared. Everybody around me was practicing for the first time, and I was just kind of sitting there wondering how it all worked. And I just went to the record store, CD store at that point, and asked them, what are people listening to? What's going on in the world of rock and roll? And they handed me this CD, and I went home and put it on, and that was the first thing that I remember hearing. And I was like, I see the light. And all of a sudden I felt relaxed and I could, go into a different chapter. I just started hanging out a little bit.
What college was this? Where were you?
This is Peabody Conservatory of Music in Baltimore. It was, again, a microwave kind of school of great intensity. And when I say I relaxed a little bit, I only practiced 4 hours a day. And but at the same time, I would go out with my friends for the first time, and I didn't go out to restaurants. I'd never really eaten out in restaurants before. And so I started listening to a lot of music around me, and I found myself curious about lots of things and paying attention to the history of music in different regards. One of the great classes I took at Peabody was the history of music and history, music and art, excuse me. And so we listened to music, and then the same period of time when that was created in a classical sense, they would go into the art world and discuss the artwork that was being presented. And then, of course, the politics of the day being in whether it be war or whatever, a renaissance. And they all kind of showed what was going on. And this next piece is very interesting because it is very similar to what we just heard. But at the very moment that I heard this was the moment that I heard that the lead singer had just died, and I researched to try to find out the life of this person, and then I put this one on. And this was again, life-changing for me. Just it's very raw, but very real.
one bone, one true religion, one race, one hope, one real decision.
Queen, One Vision. And so you mentioned that that was a song that you went on the day that Freddie Mercury died. You went and discovered that album. How did this make your list?
Just the way it made me feel. It was that time period in my life. I was I just bought my first real stereo. I just won a competition. And I went and I spent hundreds of dollars on a stereo. And I got the CDs. I got the Best of Queen, and I started listening to this stuff, and it, like Stone Temple Pilots. And, you know, around that time period was very interesting for me. Of course, with Stone Temple Pilots came Nirvana, and Soundgarden was another one that I liked a lot. Mm-hmm. Spin Doctors, Blind Melon was kind of here and there. Another thing that I just started kind of looking outside the box and seeing that occasionally cellos were in the middle of things as well. I'd already learned most of the classical repertoire for the cello, and I had this weird opportunity one time to play an MTV Unplugged event downtown in New York City. I just moved to New York City to further my studies at Juilliard, and I was asked to play the MTV Unplugged event with this guy named Seal.
Hmm.
And he had just done the soundtrack for a Batman movie. I think it was the George Clooney one. And Kiss from a Rose, all those movie, those soundtrack things. And I liked that too. And it was very kind of soul, smooth voice. And I had never really paid attention. Usually most rockers are, you know, again, very powerful, but not smoky, the smoky voices and stuff like that. So I was like, wow, that's very interesting and subtle, especially in the unplugged portion. So I started kind of going into subtlety of rock and roll versus just turning it up as loud as possible in my first few years of college. You know, during that whole time, please understand that my days were spent listening to this music when I'm walking around the city. My nights were spent at Carnegie Hall listening to Alfred Brendel and Martha Argerich and the Juilliard String Quartet and, you know, the New York Philharmonic. And then I would go home and, you know, have silence while practicing in these things. But I started right out of school, interestingly, when the I'm not a partier. I don't even like the word party. Party to me doesn't even make sense to me. But the kind of disguise of college came off. The disguise meaning the community that doesn't really exist, the forced community. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of all alone after college. And I started kind of listening to music very differently. I didn't find that music as enjoyable anymore because it didn't give me – I wanted something peaceful. I wanted something insightful. I wanted something sophisticated, again, harking back to the 1980s. And I had so much to draw from, but I found myself wanting to take walks in Central Park and ponder the next chapter of my life. And I found myself looking to the world of Johann Sebastian Bach. I don't know why. I'd never really studied it up to that point. I had heard it a lot. But one of the issues with Bach on the cello was that there is no right way to play it on the cello. And I've given this speech 100 times, but the manuscript of Bach was lost. So everyone always discussed the techniques of playing the cello. What's great about Bach in general is that it's music and can be played on any instrument. So I began looking into worlds of other instruments playing notable works that I knew, to hear it for the first time without the technical limitations that people placed on them. And in one case, I looked at the classical guitar. And in this case, I found that the classical guitar gave me freedom to explore the many voices of Bach and also give me class back in my life. Thank you.
Andrea Segovia performing Bach on the guitar. I'm talking with Azul Bailey, our castaway tonight. He's the artistic director of the Sitka Summer Music Festival and a concert cellist. And Azul has selected 10 songs to have on a deserted island, if stranded there, perhaps forever. And we're probably at song, I think we're at song number 7, and we've got 8, 9, and 10 coming up. It's high time for dessert. Azul, we've asked you to bring a dessert recipe as well that we'll post along with this program and the 10 songs you've selected on kcaw.org, and they'll be there forever for your kids and grandkids to come and learn a little bit about you at this time of your life. What dessert would you choose to have on your deserted island?
Again, it comes down to home. And my parents, and I guess I'm sort of, I would say I'm from the South. My parents are from North and South Carolina. I grew up with a dessert that was infrequent but beloved in my home. It's called apple souffle. And it's a very simple dessert, which I will put and give you all the ingredients and how to make it. But it's with either whipped cream or a scoop of vanilla ice cream on top is makes you just smile and feel like home.
So the apple souffle sounds kind of light and cinnamony.
It's very buttery. It's kind of almost bread pudding like, okay, with chunks of apple in there that are soft and mushy. And if you're lucky, the sides of the pan have crisped the edges a little bit, so you have the warm center, the crispy outside, and yet the cold chill of the ice cream that's kind of melting over everything.
So, that sounds delicious.
I'm ready to drool. Oh.
We just listened to some classical guitar, and you mentioned the different texture. Let me ask you, do you play any other instruments than the cello?
I don't. I decided just to really dedicate myself to the cello, that has been the key to open up other areas of artistic freedom to me, being an artistic director, as well as to play chamber music, whether it be a quartet, trio, sextet, septet, quartet, whatever. And so I found that was my voice, and I was going to stick with it, but I was going to use that key or that voice to try other things with it. But I've never tried to undersell that. I always want to play the best music and revel in that.
What other forms of art do you embark upon? Do you paint any or draw or write short stories or anything like that?
It's very funny. I like to tell stories. I like to, I do draw. I do sketch. Not a lot. I wouldn't call myself an artist. I have a vivid imagination. I have a real affinity for remembering visuals. I can look at something and remember it to great detail, and so I think that helps when I'm going for walks in Sitka, because I take this with me, and it also helps when I play. If anyone who's seen me play, I shut my eyes a lot, and I'm in a totally other world, and that music is coming through me, but my mind is other places. I've also said that many times I feel like I'm floating above myself when I'm playing. My mind is my most important asset. And I say that because it's running at about 1,000 miles an hour all the time, which is a problem because I don't know how to stop it. I don't see what I do as work. I don't see what I do as displeasing. I'm always thinking and anyone says that they're bored, I don't understand that on any level because I can sit, go for a walk, just dream all day long about something. The issue that I was kind of mentioning with that was that sleep is a very big issue. I can't shut it down. And so insomnia is something that's become a problem. Also, I'm on a different time zone all the time. Mm-hmm. And in the scheme of picking music and music that occupies your time while you're up, but also brings you great peace and also actually takes the pressure off of a creative mind, because like, for instance, they say that television turns everything off because everything is provided for you. So people's, their brains kind of go to jelly as they're watching TV and there is no inspiration, I find Bach, listening to Bach, peaceful yet activating. I would imagine if you did a brain scan of my brain while listening to Bach, it would light up even more, but you'd see a smile on my face like I was peaceful. And the peace that I would like to have on this desert island would be the piece that was actually written for this very problem. And it's probably one of his greatest pieces, this composer. And it was written for a person who was unable to sleep. This is by Johann Sebastian Bach.
Goldberg Variations Aria, the 1981 version, and you are sitting with Azul Bailey, the artistic director of the Sitka Summer Music Festival, and we've got a couple songs left in the 10 songs Azul would take to a deserted island if stranded there perhaps forever. Beautiful song there, Azul.
Yeah, I mean, just to watch your face even as we were listening to it, and I wish the listeners in many ways could have heard our conversation while we were listening to it. It's exactly what it is. It creates such beauty and peace and inspired conversation. But this is where I was. I listen to and find and research this kind of music now to kind of parallel what is happening in my life. As you've seen over the past hour and a half, the music has been the soundtrack to my personalized life and what has been going on and my awakenings and my struggles in some cases and my loves of the cello and how it all comes together in the end. You know, one has to be careful what they wish for in this life because in some cases you might just get it. For my entire life, I have wanted to be a cellist. From the age of six, I wanted to be a cellist. And what does that mean? Well, I didn't know at the time. I knew that it meant traveling. I knew it meant playing in stages all over the world. And I made that my complete focus. And I really was very one-sided in not knowing that there are other things in life other than just traveling and playing and sharing music with the world. And I didn't know that I would actually want other things as life goes on and your chemistry changes and you start to broaden as a human being. The next selection is very interesting to me because I, over the past several years, I've broadened out into more peaceful music, kind of folky music that I listen to when I'm just kind of in my home, which is very infrequent. And the selection is very interesting to me, not only from the title of the song, but also the kind of bringing together the full reason why I play the cello, the uniqueness of the voice, in that it's got texture, unique depth, a very distinctive fingerprint, something that you hear immediately, you know what it is and who it is, if you're knowing of this person, of course. And of course, the lyrics kind of define, be careful what you wish for, because it brings a side to things that you never guessed. So.
Back to love and each other.
That was Ray LaMontagne, Home for the Summer. Summer is obviously home for me is Sitka. And this is one of the reasons why I chose and was accepted being the artistic director of the Sitka Summer Music Festival, is that I'm able to surround myself with the most important people to me, which includes my family and my friends and my colleagues, in the most beautiful place on earth.
I was walking through the campus last week and saw you playing frisbee with your boys. Do you have two sons? It was a little ways away, but you throw a pretty mean frisbee, I have to say. I don't know if you're in those pickup ultimate frisbee games, but I think you'd be welcome.
Thank you.
And what a beautiful campus to spend time on, isn't
Absolutely.
It? You were talking this last break about choosing to spend a life immersed in music and sharing the music. And sharing the music inherently means being on a stage. It means performing for a group of people, sometimes small, sometimes huge. And so being on that stage is a different place to be. And there's a perspective from being on stage that I'd like you to explore a little bit or share a little bit, maybe. One of your best experiences on stage, and then maybe to counterbalance it with one of your most frightening or worst or frustrating experiences on stage.
Well, I tend to be a glasses half full kind of guy, so let's talk about the best. Because those are the ones that I really remember.
All right.
And those are the ones that keep bringing me back. When you're on stage and you have, when you're looking at however many people are out there, whether it be a couple of hundred or a few thousand, and you're playing music that means the world to you, and you've spent so much time preparing for it and done all the research and... research meaning you know why it was written. I typically play with my eyes shut. But occasionally I'll open my eyes during one of these moments that I just cannot believe this is happening. And the majority of the audience has their eyes closed. And they know nothing about the music. They know nothing that I know except for the fact that I have been able to freeze their lives and give them a moment that they'll never forget. I typically try to find a moment like that in every concert. The moment varies, the intensity varies. Those moments are what we remember. We don't remember the bombast. We remember the quiet moments, the whispers, I don't know, the hugs, those warm moments. And so, and this is kind of, it kind of leads us into, I don't know if you want to play it now, but the last selection, being on the road all the time and having two boys, I don't get to see them a lot. I get to see them in Sitka. But every CD I make, I do one piece on the CD for them that has a tie-in to something that I have with them personally. And, obviously we could go through every disc and I could find it, but there is one particular track that represents something, I think, for everybody, mostly mothers. But for me, it was coming into the house when they were asleep, having been gone for a long time, and sitting there with them and singing to them. And I made a point of recording this for them. And when they call me and I'm on the road and they miss me, I ask them to put this on and let them fall asleep listening to this. Because this was absolutely for them. So on the desert island, if I had this to listen to, it would make me very much tear up and remember, the wonders of family and those two little boys. Thank you.
Zul, do you ever play that for your kids in their bedroom when they're getting ready to go to bed?
No, no. That was for them, for themselves. Mm-hmm. And usually when I sang it to them, they were asleep. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of those things, going back to the Gershwin Rhapsody in Blue, other things from my childhood, that is for them to remember their dad on their own. And I have my own feelings about that. But yeah, it would be difficult for me to even play that in concert if they were in the hall.
Mm-hmm. Zul Bailey, thank you so much for being with me tonight and for putting these selections of music together and for explaining why and for letting us get to know you a little bit better. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A real pleasure to have cast you away and heard about your island and your thoughts and your music, but we're going to rescue you now. The boat is on the horizon, and it's going to toot a couple of times and head over and launch the raft and pick you up and bring you back to the world of people that you love and music that you love and doing the things that you love all in and around the world.